From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange. Arizona's crackdown on illegal immigrants has sparked renewed debate in Iowa. Over the weekend, the three Republican candidates for governor vowed to adopt similar legislation, while advocates for immigrant families rallied in Des Moines demanding comprehensive reform that includes a path to citizenship. A clergy member in Iowa City wants to make his community a sanctuary city, giving undocumented workers protection from local intervention in federal immigration laws. What is the right policy for Iowa? Should the children of illegal immigrants qualify for in-state tuition at the public universities? This hour, we'll discuss the future of undocumented workers in Iowa with both supporters and opponents of immigration reform. That's coming up next on The Exchange, but first,
from NPR
the news.
In Washington.
Two of the largest immigration raids in the United States occurred in Iowa, the 2006 Swift & Company raid in Marshalltown and Postville's agriprocessors raid in 2008. I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Today, we're going to discuss immigration in Iowa. As we've talked about ahead of the show, you know that Arizona's new law has raised issues in Iowa, many saying Iowa should pass similar legislation, some saying the Arizona law is racial profiling and unconstitutional. Our guests are going to discuss that law and the current situation in Iowa. Let's start with David Cook-Martin, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Grinnell College. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
Hi, Janine. It's nice to be here today.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your research. What's the current state of immigration in Iowa? Are there up-to-date numbers from the census and from your research?
Well, my research is not specifically about Iowa. My understanding of the recent immigration trends in Iowa is that they follow the national trend, and that is that recently we've actually seen a slight decline in the number of people coming to the U.S. and also to Iowa. Of course, prior to that, Iowa had seen substantial increases in migration to the state, maybe for the last 10 years or so. And you mentioned a couple of examples from recent Iowa history that have brought that to people's minds, the Swift raid and the 2008 Postville raid. But more recently, we've actually seen a slight decline in the number of folks coming to the U.S. and also to Iowa.
We often focus on Hispanics in Iowa, and those are the faces we see after a raid that are subject to either detention or sometimes deportation. But are there other populations that immigrate to Iowa that are not Hispanic? That do so illegal. I think we know that there are other populations that immigrate to Iowa, whether it be Bosnians or any group, but that do so illegally in large numbers.
I think the biggest chunk of folks who come to Iowa undocumented are primarily from Latin America, primarily from Mexico. But yes, obviously, as Postville clearly shows, a number of folks from Central America have come to Iowa, and I think that in that number we even had folks from Eastern Europe as well. Because of the very phenomenon of undocumentation, it's very hard to have a precise number, but I think the most recent Department of Homeland Security figures show that it's a number somewhere around 55 to 80,000. Total. I think that probably I'd say a third to half of those are from Mexico, and then the others from a variety of nationalities, many of them from Central America.
Let's talk about Arizona's law, because it's garnered a lot of conversation here in Iowa and many other states. I read today that as many as 12 or more states are considering adopting similar legislation. And in fact, I think you could safely bet that if the Iowa legislature were currently in session, you would have some Republican lawmakers in this state proposing legislation. What does it do? Because we seem to hear a lot of different topics, but I think the average person may not know exactly what the law does.
Right. So Senate Bill 1070, the Arizona law that was passed in mid-April, basically is intended to ensure that federal immigration law is followed to its full extent, and I'm essentially citing some of the content of the law here. Among some of its provisions are that it would require that during any lawful contact between law enforcement or any agency official of the state, at all levels, if a person is suspected of being unlawfully present in the U.S., a reasonable attempt would be made to determine their immigration status. Another provision is that any person could bring suit in superior court against law enforcement agencies or other agencies if they suspect that these agencies or officials have not pursued immigration law to the fullest extent possible. It also adds a charge of trespassing to any person detained and found to be in violation of immigration law who is on publicly held land or buildings. The law also has a series of measures aimed at employers of undocumented and unauthorized workers, as well as about human trafficking and the drug trade, which are major concerns in a border state like Arizona. Proponents like Governor Brewer and Representative Kavanaugh in Arizona have claimed that the law is aimed at making Arizona a safer place, and that in no way is it intended to diminish civil rights. Representative Kavanaugh, one of the sponsors of the law, said that the law's philosophy of attrition through enforcement is really intended to create so much fear that unauthorized migrants would leave on their own, and then taxes and crime would go down. So that's sort of the content of the law. I think that it's problematic on multiple levels. If you'd like, I can point out some of the issues that I think are going to come up around its implementation and enforcement.
Well, and let's do that, because many have suggested, well, this is just requiring, in some ways, Arizona to enforce current federal law. And yet others are saying, well, no, now you can be stopped or, held for just the possibility of being here illegally. Talk to me about those.
Right. Okay, so yes, one of the shifts here is you could say that this is really just requiring people to follow federal law, but it is going a bit further in asking that law enforcement officials, as I mentioned earlier, and not only law enforcement officials but other state agents, make some sort of determination when they come into lawful contact with someone about their immigration status. The issue that this raises is the possibility of profiling people in some ethnic or racial way. Now, the proponents, as I said earlier, say this is not the case, but I've spoken to some of my law enforcement friends, and they say that it'd be very difficult to implement or do what this law requires without selecting people based on perceived racial or national origins. So on the ground, it would be very difficult to carry out without some level of profiling. The other thing that's problematic about the law is that, as you might have inferred from some of the previous statements I made, that it links immigration to criminality. As if they are sides of the same coin. And this basically goes against some of the best available evidence that we have. The Bureau of Justice Statistics data show that there's actually a declining violent crime rate for Arizona for the last 10 years of available data. That's basically 99 through 2008. And some of my sociologist colleagues have demonstrated pretty amply that immigration is actually inversely related to crime rates. So it's sort of a problematic claim if what is being suggested is that immigrants are criminals in some sense. Now, if this is about the drug trade...
And let me ask you, let me just stop you there and ask you a quick question. When you say criminality, Is it a given that coming to the country without documentation means you've committed an illegal act, in your opinion? And if that's the case, are you talking about a secondary criminal offense, you know, whether it be anything from as minor as speeding to as a much more, you know, theft,
sure,
drug dealing,
sure,
anything like that? So or are you saying even the initial act of coming to the country is not illegal?
Well, I'm not saying that. Obviously, if someone enters in an unauthorized manner, they're here. They are out of legal status. So yes, but I don't think that that's what folks are saying when they link criminality and immigration all of the time. Especially in this bill, they're saying, especially in statements around this bill, what I think people are suggesting is that there is a link between immigrants and the crime rate, and specifically the violent crime rate. So that's what I infer when, you know, the governor says that Arizona will now be safe, right? That we won't have that level of crime. And yet, as I just mentioned, the statistics actually show that violent crime rate is actually declining in Arizona. But I'm fairly certain that that's what folks are talking about.
Sure.
As I said earlier, though, of course, yes, there's a drug trade, a human trafficking aspect to living on the border that Arizona has to deal with that other states don't have to deal with.
All right. Let's bring on Ira Melman, media director for the Federation for American and Immigration Reform. Mr. Melman, tell me about your group and what you think of the Arizona law.
Well, we support the Arizona law. You know, Arizona is taking these measures because the federal government has consistently failed to do its job. They have failed to control the border. They have failed to enforce immigration laws in the interior of the country. And the people in Arizona are paying the price. And, you know, contrary to what the professor just said, there is an association with crime. Phoenix has become the kidnapping capital of the Western Hemisphere, and it is largely because of criminal organizations that have moved their operations across the border. There was recently the murder of the rancher down along the border in Arizona. So this is affecting people's lives in terms of crime. It is also affecting people's lives in terms of tax dollars that are paid. It is costing Arizona now more than $2 billion a year to provide basic services to illegal aliens and their children, especially at a time when the state is in deep fiscal crisis like every other state in the country. It is having effect on vital social institutions, overcrowded classrooms where half the kids may not speak English. So this is profoundly affecting the lives of Arizonans in every way. The state simply said, look, the federal government isn't doing the job. We have an obligation to protect the people, and we're going to do it ourselves. We're simply going to enforce and implement federal immigration laws.
All right, Mr. Melman, when we come back from this break, I want to talk to you a little bit about what your group advocates for, which includes a moratorium on immigration at the time. We'll take a quick break. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Good afternoon. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Janine Beck, and today we're talking about illegal immigration and whether the states should play a role in enforcing the federal immigration laws. Some say the federal government has not enforced them strongly enough and that states should play a role. Others say, no, it's a federal issue and that there should be substantial reform. We're talking with Ira Melman, director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform Group, known as FAIR. And let me ask you, you're advocating a temporary moratorium on all immigration except spouses and minor children of U.S. citizens. Is that right?
Well, you know, we believe that the immigration policies of this country no longer make sense for the interest of the United States. You know, most often people tend to look at immigration from the perspective of immigrants or the direct employers of immigrants. Now, obviously, immigration always benefits immigrants. Nobody picks up and leaves one country and moves to another unless it provides some substantial benefit to them. And obviously, the direct employers also benefit because, number one, they get workers who are generally willing to work at lower wages. And also, the simple law of supply and demand says that the more workers you have, the lower the cost of labor. The issue that we have to look at is what is the impact on everybody else in society. And, you know, I think we can make a very good case that our immigration policies are not serving the general interest of most Americans. We need to reformulate our immigration policies. We need to end primarily the policy of endless chain migration, where one extended family member follows another extended family member, irrespective of their personal qualifications. What we need to do is come up with a policy that makes sense for the United States in the 21st century, and you can't do that until you shut down the old system and actually sit down and try to work out something that makes more sense for our current situation.
You know, you talked about how maybe the majority of Americans are not benefiting from this. I'm going to try to play devil's advocate here. I'm thinking of day laborers or those who pick fruit and vegetables or do jobs that in some cases, when the wages are lower, then the price of the product is lower. Is there, would there be jobs that dry up if immigrants were not in the country as people, there may not be the workforce to do them, or if prices or labor went up, would the prices of products go up? I mean, is there a correlation there?
You know, there may be some jobs that would disappear altogether, but those jobs were probably unnecessary and were created to take advantage of the fact that you had this cheap pool of labor available in the first place. You know, yes, there may be some additional costs passed along to the consumer if we had to pay higher wages. Look, I mean, everybody says we need higher wages for workers. Immigration has actually been a way of tamping down wage increases for a lot of workers in our society. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with seeing wages increase. You have to remember that you're not getting a free ride here. You're simply paying for these services and products out of a different pocket. Instead of paying for it as a consumer, you're paying for it as a taxpayer. There is no such thing as a free lunch. There is no such thing as cheap labor in the United States. When a worker comes and says, let's say works at a meatpacking plant in Iowa at low wages, they put their kids in school, they use public health care, those are all coming out of your pocket as a taxpayer. You would probably have been far better off to simply pay the honest wage and pay an honest price for the product at the supermarket.
Let me ask you about that, because you said that they go to school, they use public health care. Now, the school issue is true. There was a court ruling that said, obviously, that children of undocumented workers could attend public education, but they are not allowed to receive state-funded health insurance, welfare, food stamps, and in fact are required to, I assume there may be some who don't, but are required to pay all taxes. So if they have a job at Swift & Company in Marshalltown, they're being taxed. So they're not benefiting from those state services they're being taxed for. So is it really coming out of my pocketbook? Education, obviously, but in other ways?
Well, yes. I mean, just a few weeks ago, you know, we passed April 15th, and there were a lot of stories about the fact that 47% of households in the U.S. don't pay any federal tax because they're not earning enough. So, you know, even assuming that some of these people are working under bogus Social Security numbers and that the employer is actually withholding, and only about half of the illegal aliens in the country have withholding taken out of their paychecks. The other half are not paying any taxes at all, at least no income taxes. There may be some incidental sales taxes along the way. But, you know, if you were earning low wages to begin with, there's very little you can pay in taxes. You know, in most places in the country, it costs between $8,000 and $10,000 a year to provide public education for a child for 1 year. If you have a family income of $20,000, $25,000, $30,000, there is no way that you can pay enough in taxes on that kind of income to cover the cost of one child in school, much less multiple children in school. You know, we simply have to face reality. You don't get something for nothing. You're going to pay for it one way or the other. And when you start paying for it through the tax system, through government benefit programs, you're going to wind up paying more for it than if you had simply paid people honestly, provided them with decent, honest wages and decent working conditions.
Mr. Melman, do you have any Iowa-specific figures? I know that you try to compile those for different states.
Yeah, FAIR did a report on the cost of illegal immigration in Iowa. I think it was a 2007 study. Our estimate was that it was costing the state about $241 million a year to provide K-12 education, unreimbursed health care, and incarcerate criminal illegal aliens. These are illegal aliens who not only broke our immigration law, but also subsequently committed some offense in Iowa that caused them to be incarcerated. So those three programs alone cost the state about $240 million a year. And, you know, I don't know quite what the state of the Iowa budget is, but I'm guessing that it's probably is in as bad a shape as most other states these days. And $240 million is a lot of money.
Professor Cook-Martin, let me ask you about those numbers, because the numbers he just cited are even higher than a report that many say is flawed from the Legislative Services Agency, a nonpartisan group, that suggested Iowa may pay up to $100 million a year for services for illegal immigrants.
Right. Well, let me say two things. One, the first thing is that I would want to look at the methodologies of both reports, as I'm sure Mr. Melman would, carefully. And one thing I know is, that's a huge difference is the way that the FAIR report looks at education, in that it considers the education of U.S.-born children of immigrants in and factors that into the cost. That's one comment that I would make. So I, you know, I'm happy to get into the details, but I think that that makes it particularly problematic because we're really talking about U.S. citizens. The other thing is about how this is being framed. So you can think about immigration as a zero-sum game and sort of think of it in terms of a ledger. And, of course, we need to be mindful of costs and benefits. But you can also take a more investment-focused approach. Do we want to have a competitive workforce, not only on the national level, but here's the rub. All of the things that we're talking about might make sense if we lived in a world where the U.S. was the only country. But we live in a global marketplace, and capital and investment looks for labor that is either cheap or extremely well qualified. And if we take a sort of an isolationist view, which I take to be the point that's being made by Mr. Melman, I think that we're going to lose out in the global trade arena.
Mr. Melman, let me ask you, when you talk about a hiatus or a moratorium on new immigration, what do you do or what does your organization suggest doing with the current population that is here? Should there be some sort of path to citizenship? Should we be working more or harder at sending them back to their countries of origin? What should be done?
Well, no, I mean, we take the basic position that I think was stated in the objective of the Arizona law that we've been discussing, which is attrition through enforcement. What we have going for us is that illegal aliens are rational people. They come here for very, very rational reasons. They believe that if they can get here, they will be able to get access to jobs, they will be able to get access to at least some benefits and services that local police, if they come across them, are simply going to turn a blind eye and send them on their way. If you change those conditions, if you make it clear that you're not going to be able to get a job very easily because we're out there looking for the employers and we're going to slap the employers the way we did in Postville, those jobs will dry up. You know, it's the same sort of law enforcement technique that, say, the highway patrol uses when they want to enforce the speed limit. They don't pull over every speeder. They pull over a few. You're cruising along at 80 miles an hour. You take your foot off the gas. Same thing is true of employers. When the guy in Postville gets busted, the guy in Storm Lake says, wait a minute, maybe I ought not to be hiring illegal aliens because I don't need this kind of trouble. So if you eliminate the supply of jobs, the numbers will eventually begin to dwindle, and I think you pointed this out in the opening, that the numbers have actually declined in the past few years. And it's really irrelevant to the illegal aliens why the jobs disappear. It's irrelevant whether it's because the economy has tanked or because we're enforcing the law and employers are afraid to hire illegal aliens. The bottom line is no jobs, fewer come, more will decide to go home. We're never going to have zero. There is no law made by man or God that has 100% compliance, and I assure you this will not be the exception. But we don't have to capitulate, basically, to people who violated our law by granting amnesty to all of them.
So, okay, I have to stop you there. We have to take a quick break. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a few minutes on The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. And this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Janine Beck, and today we're discussing immigration, specifically illegal immigration. As you may remember, Iowa has had two of the largest immigration raids in the United States, the 2006 Swift & Company raid in Marshalltown and the Postville Agriprocessors raid in 2008. For the first half of the program, we focused largely on financial and legal issues surrounding immigration. The second half of the hour, we'd like to put a face, or at least in this case, a voice to it, to talk about some of the human stories attached to immigration. I want to start by taking a call from Nancy. Nancy is joining us on the phone this hour. Nancy, thanks for calling The Exchange.
Hi.
Go ahead. Tell me a little bit about your story.
Well, the police came to my house and just took my fiancé away.
And your fiancé is an immigrant?
Yes.
Okay. And so he was found to be here illegally?
Well, he's not found to be anything. He's been here since 99.
Mm-hmm. And where's he from? Nancy, I think one of the difficulties, I think you have your radio on in the background. If you turn that down, it'll be easier for you to...
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, this is just very frustrating because we have a son also that's only 5 months old, and they came to our house and took him away.
And how did he come to their attention? Was he employed? Was he pulled over? What had happened?
No, they just said they had a call. They didn't say anything that day particularly. You know, they just came, knocked at our door really early in the morning one day and said something about firearms, you know, like if we had anything like that in our house and things like that. And they searched our house. Our son was laying in our bed, and it was a very traumatic ordeal. Right now, he's still going through the court, so I don't know. I should go through all this stuff right now. But
sure.
They kept him for a long time. He's still in the jail right now.
Is that some of your frustration, is that when this happens, that the process is sometimes unclear for those left behind? There's not a lot of communication. Or do you think there needs to be changes to the law? What would you like see happen?
Yeah, just more education for the families. I don't really like that they just come and take your family apart.
Well, Nancy, we wish you the best of luck. Thanks so much for calling today. Please take care. Nancy just happened to be listening to the program, but one of our other guests today is Maria Alvarez, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement youth leader of the All Latino chapter in Marshalltown. And Maria has suffered a similar fate earlier in her life when her mother, who was working at the Swift & Company plant in Marshalltown, was detained in that raid in 2006. Maria, thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
When you listen to Nancy and clearly the fear in her voice, does it bring back memories of what happened to your family in 2006? You were a teenager at the time, just 18?
Yeah, I was actually in my senior year.
Of high school?
Yeah, of high school. And while we've always talked about this, like while everybody was getting ready for prom, I was worrying how to get my mom out of a detention center. As I hear Nancy, he's just like, it's so ridiculous to me how I understand the laws. I grew up here. I went to school here. I was educated here. I went through kindergarten. I was brought to the United States when I was 4 years old with my younger brother and my mom. And when we got here, the whole process was new to us. I grew up here. This is the only thing that I know. If I was to be sent back to Mexico, I would not know how to fit in again. I would not know, like, basically, I know my customs and everything, but it's not the same thing. Like, I consider the United States to be my home. And one of the things that I find very offensive is that I'm considered an illegal alien. The act is illegal. I am not illegal. So a lot of the times, groups and different organizations want to label us illegal aliens to take the humane side away from it, to realize that we are no longer people, that we're going to be considered animals or criminals or even worse. And as I hear Nancy, it's just like I honestly feel her pain because a lot of these immigration people, ICE people, came into our homes. They didn't follow their rules, their guidelines that they're supposed to be following. They basically, a lot of the time, the people didn't even know they were from ICE. They just basically came into our homes, took parents in front of their kids, arrested moms in front of their kids, and even at times took the little kids with them, and which is something unacceptable if we're even talking about following an immigration system. If it applies to all of us and the laws apply to all of us, they should be considered liable for what they are doing also, not only us.
Let's talk to Father Rudolph Juarez of St. Patrick's Church in Iowa City. You've heard two compelling stories now, and your work is to make Iowa City a sanctuary city. Explain to our listeners what that is.
Right. Well, before I get into that, I just wanted to respond to a couple things that Mr. Melman had said. First of all, I think we're kind of in agreement, believe it or not. Mr. Melman seems to be an advocate for just and fair wages. So maybe he's a good union man, I don't know. But I certainly would fall on that side of things in terms of the need to have fair and just wages, which is an incentive, I think, for everybody. The other thing that he had said is that the immigration laws as they stand right now do not serve the general need or the general public. The reality is that all of us, simply by the fact that we're Americans living in a free country, in the United States, we all benefit from immigration because immigrants contribute to the fabric of our society. They're working hard. The vast majority come here for good and noble reasons, not to engage in illegal activity. So I would be in agreement with Mr. Melman on the fact that we do need fair and just wages. The other thing, and the reason for that is because one of the tenets of Catholic social teaching is that the economy is at the service of the human person, not the other way around. So the other thing is that he called for a moratorium on immigration, and I'm thinking, well, you know, maybe that's a good idea, but I would preface it with this caveat that there should be a moratorium on the immigration system as it is now. So, in other words, we need to reform immigration so that it is more reflective of our current reality in the United States and in the world. So that's the other thing. The other element is the very human side of it. And here in Iowa City, from different religious perspectives, we've come together from the Presbyterian Church, from the Mennonite Church, from the Unitarian Church, a fellowship, and from Roman Catholic communities to advocate for a more just and humane treatment of individuals, to create a safer community, to allow people to be participants in the greater community according to their ability. And the thing about the Arizona law is that it runs the risk of destabilizing the community. We talk about crime growing up. We talk about tax dollars. We talk about all this fear mongering. Well, you know, the thing is that prior to 9/11, we didn't have this kind of atmosphere in the country. And in fact, Iowa was one of the leaders in trying to establish welcome centers for new arrivals to Iowa. The fact is that Iowa is impacted by immigration. But it's also impacted by the fact that we're not able to keep our college-educated students here in Iowa. They're leaving Iowa. Fact is that we have an older population, so that's impacting Iowa. And the fact is that we do have people who are coming here who are younger, and that a large section of that population is immigrant. And the children of immigrants. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So you would like to, in some ways, expand Iowa's population base, which is, as you said, shrinking, with new Iowans being immigrants and may not be concerned if they've come documented or undocumented.
Well, like or not like, the reality is that we already have this happening within the state. I mean, so the...
Yeah, but there are many right. who would like to stop it from happening.
Well, I think Mr. Melman is advocating that type of approach. But the reality is that it's not... I don't think it's going to work. I don't know that you, because the fact is that Iowa, like the United States, is a participant in a global economy and a global reality.
Let's talk about that. We have an email from Judy and who says, why is it that U.S. trade policies are rarely discussed in relation to unauthorized immigration? Since the implementation of NAFTA, over 2 million small farmers have been pushed off the land in Mexico because they cannot compete with subsidized cheap corn that we dump in their country. This is according to Judy in an email. What about our economy in connection with other countries' economies? Is there something that the United States should be doing to, if they believe immigration is a problem, to boost the economy of other countries?
Well, I think we always have to look at, and I think the person that sent the email is absolutely correct. There's our international policy, economic policies does impact the world, and it has a way of impacting us as well. Obviously, you know, not every economy is as strong as it could be or should be. And those economic factors impact why people will risk lemon and to come to the United States. I don't know that we can say that the United States does not have the right to protect its borders, because we do and we should, especially against criminal elements. But the fact is that there are economic and social pressures, political pressures, that move people to take these kinds of steps to want to come to a free country.
All right, let's go back to the phones and talk to Joe in Des Moines. Joe, thanks for calling The Exchange.
Hey, thanks for having me. You know, I kind of, part of me agrees with the immigration policy being enforced, and other part of it I'm in disagreement with, and mainly because I've been involved in two accidents in Des Moines, both of which were deemed not my fault, but the other individuals involved in the accident were here illegally. And the only repercussion the law enforcement had was to send them back to their country. And because of that, my insurance rate goes up. And I feel that if they're going to be here, that's fine, but they need to at least own up to their responsibility while they are here.
Well,
so
the
they
fact
didn't,
is,
in your opinion, let me
okay,
just ask Joe a follow-up. So, Joe, they did not have insurance, car insurance?
They did not have insurance. The law enforcement informed me that they were here illegally and that they were going to take the steps to deport them.
And that often doesn't happen because of the cost involved in that. There's often a long waiting period for the federal government to come in and do the paperwork. And the local law enforcement, when they detain someone like that, often foots the bill in the meantime.
Right. But if they're here illegally, that's one point. But if they're here illegally, the least they should do is own up to their responsibility, carry insurance, or at least cover the cost of repairs to the vehicle so that my insurance doesn't have to incur those expenses.
Well, one of the facts, if I could respond to the caller's comments, is that the movement behind getting people to be able to have licenses in the state of Iowa anyway, and in other states, was for that very fact that Joe points out. The fact is that people cannot drive, cannot get insurance. It would make so much more economic and business sense to allow people to have licenses, to be able to drive, to be able to purchase auto insurance, so situations like that would be minimized.
Let me ask you, I don't think we got to it, Father Juarez, again about what a sanctuary city is. And there's actual action taking place on that tonight, correct, in Iowa City?
Right. Sanctuary city is a movement to create an atmosphere in a particular community in which we say, as long as you are a contributing member of society, as long as you're not involved in any criminal activity, then you should be able to benefit from the services that our community provides. By that we mean, for instance, if somebody is a witness to a crime and their status is still not determined in terms of their legal status in the country, that these individuals would feel safe enough to be able to come to police authorities and say, hey, I saw this happen, and I want to give my testimony. If we are stringent in terms of, you know, wanting to enforce legal status, it could be that that person would not feel safe enough to go and say, well, I was a witness to a crime, because all of a sudden their presence would come under scrutiny. So in other words, they wouldn't feel safe to be able to report a crime or to come forward as a witness to a crime. That's one of the things.
Let me bring in Mr. Melman, director of the Federation for American and Immigration Reform. React to that. Our sanctuary cities, and I think I read on one website there are about 50 across the country, none in Iowa. Are they a good idea?
No, they're a terrible idea. Number one, you know, police, when they take witness statements, when people are victims of crimes, that's not the time to ask about people's immigration status. I don't know of any police department that actually does that. What I'm hearing is, you know, because people have broken one law, we now have to accommodate them by providing all sorts of other things, driver's licenses, assurances that if they come in and ask for social services, nobody's going to ask any questions. What we need to do is start to enforce our immigration laws. And, you know, it's also interesting, you know, the Catholic Church has taken a very vocal position on this. I would imagine in Iowa City, like in any other diocese around the country, that they probably run the second largest school system. I've yet to hear one of the archbishops step up to the microphone and say, you know what, you let all these people come. They're not going to be a burden on the public schools. We'll provide the education. We'll provide the health care. We run hospitals. We run clinics. You never hear anybody stepping up to the microphone and taking that kind of responsibility. But, you know, I'd also like to address some of the personal stories that we heard a bit earlier. I think we all empathize with the position that these families are in. But we have to get back to what the root cause was. The root cause was that somebody in the family decided to break the law.
Let me just stop you there. Yes, they decided to break the law, but was that the first decision they made? It seems to me, as a parent, the first decision may have been, I can't feed and clothe my children anymore in the country I'm in. I'm going to go to a country where I have a better shot at doing that. And if that means breaking the law, that will be the step I take. I mean, I think...
There have to be consequences. If there are no consequences to breaking laws, then it's pointless to have laws. And what we need, is social reform in places like Mexico. The fact that we have been serving as a safety valve for Mexico has allowed them to perpetuate a corrupt system, a corrupt political and economic system, where the people at the top skim off all the wealth of the country. They leave the rest of the population destitute.
Are we talking about Wall Street here, or what are we talking about?
What is happening here is that, you know, the issue of NAFTA came up. First of all, you know, as I recall, the president of Mexico's signature was on that document also, so it's not just our responsibility and our policies. It was a trilateral policy between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. They have to take responsibility for the consequences. But again, let's stipulate that it was a bad deal, that it has hurt workers in Mexico. It has hurt middle-class workers here in the United States. The fat cats in Wall Street and the fat cats in Mexico City have taken most of the profits, and now some poor guy in Marshalltown has to pay for it with his job. That's not fair.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there. I want to give Maria a chance to speak here, because Maria's had a very little amount of time so far and is someone who lives in a community that is probably one of the largest immigrant populations in the state, at least one of the largest Hispanic populations in the state. It is not a sanctuary city. Talk to me about growing up in Marshalltown. You are one of five siblings, three of which were born here, so are naturalized U.S. citizens, or who are U.S. citizens. You are not. Your brother is not. What did you feel like growing up? Could you have gone to the police if you saw something? And what is your future like? Do you have access to college? Do you have access to financial aid because you're not a U.S. citizen?
No. Like I said, I understand that the process of coming here, what my mother did was wrong. I understand that. But then I also understand that we were starving in Mexico and that she would have given her life for us to have a better opportunity. Once we were here, we've been here 16 years. Like I said, I went through the whole education system, so did my brother. During 16 years, we've applied for a visa for any sort of hope, and it's taken 16 years, a raid, an arrest, and charges against my mother for us to even see a little bit of hope now. And like growing up here, you go through the system. You think they this is not, you not only think, they you consider yourself a citizen, and we do anything for our community, including volunteering, including helping out in different departments and schools and churches, cleaning the streets. We do everything as a normal citizen does. But still,
do you,
we
so you consider yourself an American currently, Maria?
I do. I am an American.
Sure. And do you have a chance at citizenship? Do you expect over the course of the next years that you will have that opportunity?
Because of the raid, a judge declared my mom, gave my mom the opportunity to apply for her residency, and he gave it to her. The judge gave my mom her residency because she had no criminal record. She had never gotten arrested. She had never gotten a ticket in her life and all the volunteer work that she had done. During that process, my mom also applied for myself and for my brother. But still, we're waiting on a report from the immigration to see how long the wait has to be for us, even though we've been here all our lives.
Right.
The only other thing like I could say to Mr. Merlin is that I'm sure that if you were in my mother's position, you would try to do anything you possibly could to make a better life for your children. And I'm pretty sure that once you felt the hunger that we felt, you would have done the same thing.
All right, Maria, I have to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time. Maria Alvarez with the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement Youth Leader, All Latino Chapter in Marshalltown. Professor David Cook-Martin of Grinnell College, thank you. Ira Melman, the Media Director for the Federation of American Immigration Reform, and Father Rudolph Juarez of St. Patrick's Church in Iowa City, thank you so much for the discussion today. For those of you who called, we appreciate it. For those we didn't get on, I apologize. Program today produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance from Rosalind Sixby. Technical support from Dennis Reese and John Pemble. I'm Janine Beck. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio.